Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Ritchie, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
We are back from our holidays. I hope you all enjoyed our interviews with Jack Rayner and Lynn Shelton last week. It was really fun for me to talk to Lynn, really fun for me to listen to Richard talk to Jack Rayner, and then look at Jack's Instagram, which made me feel incredibly stupid for all of the movies that I have not seen that he knows everything about. And maybe it'll make me less scared of Midsommar when I finally work up the guts to see it. Anyway, we're back, and we are really close to the Emmy nominations announcements, which will be out next Tuesday. We're going to have a special episode talking about them right after they happen. So this is the week to predict what's actually going to get nominated, as we've been talking about for months. But there's a couple little movie things we wanted to talk about before we get into that. And this week is the release of Lulu Wang's The Farewell, which has been really, I think, probably the most successful movie out of Sundance, or like buzz-wise, like people just adored it. And Richard, you're the only one of us who's seen it, so I kind of just wanted you give you a chance to, I don't know, tell everyone how great The Farewell is.
Yeah, I think if there's going to be a sleeper indie hit of the summer, which we've not really had yet, although I guess Midsommar could count on that regard, The Farewell would be it, because it's got stuff to please those looking for artistry and interesting casting and filmmaking, but also it's a crowd-pleaser family dramedy with, you know, Awkwafina's popular actress from Ocean's 8 and other things. So I think it satisfies two different needs that people might have in this pretty dull movie summer. So I have high hopes for it, you know. Hopes all the way that could, you know, to the Oscars, because I think its screenplay at least could be a thing. Although I know Mike is also agitating for an acting nomination.
Was it Awkwafina who had the acting buzz, or was it someone else in the cast?
Well, Awkwafina, yeah, maybe, but really, I think the one that Mike is into is Xu Zhen Zhao, who plays the grandmother, who is the centerpiece of the story and in some ways of the film. And I think that would be really exciting because she really is great. I believe she's a first-time actress, which is, well, at least this is her first credit on IMDb. So that could be kind of a cool narrative.
So like a Yalitza Aparicio situation all over again?
Yeah, something along those lines, sure. And I mean, I could see it because it's hard not to fall in love with her character. You know, the movie roughly is about a family all descending on in you know, their home city in China, Awkwafina's character from New York City, to celebrate a wedding ostensibly, but actually the grandmother is dying. And I guess it is tradition in parts of China, if an elder person is dying of a disease, you just don't tell them. So they don't, you know, so they're not, you know, like constantly, you know, facing death in the face. And so it's a funny premise, it's a sad premise, it's a true premise based on something that actually happened to writer-director Lulu Wang. And so in that, you get different characters interacting with Nei Nei, the grandmother, and it's just wonderful watching Xu Zhen Zhao, you know, do all that. So I don't know, I hope people go see it. There was a big party for it in New York this week that I did not go to, but it seemed to have been quite the event, judging by Instagram, with something you pointed out, Katie.
Yeah, everyone, I woke up in the morning and everyone I know apparently was in the same photo booth at the Farewell party, which, I mean, it says a lot about, I mean, a lot of people love the Farewell already, so it's not like they're just hangers-on, but A24 really knows how to very niche market something like that and get a lot of people talking about it, which is really smart. That's what small movies like this need.
Yeah, and I wanted to sort of follow up on that, which is, Katie, you talked about The Farewell having sort of the most, I don't know, critical buzz possibly out of Sundance, but Late Night is another film that came out of Sundance with so much buzz, this Mindy Kaling, Emma Thompson film that was picked up by Amazon for so much money and then just did nothing. And now to the point where there are stories that, you know, heads will roll at Amazon for this decision. This seriously is going to make them rethink their film acquisition strategy, all this sort of stuff. So like what kind of cautionary tale can Late Night provide that The Farewell can miss? Are these apples and oranges? Like, what do you guys think of those two stories?
Well, and now I'm just quoting something I heard on The Bachelorette, which I don't watch regularly. Happened to catch an episode last night where the Bachelorette was trying to make a choice between four, you know, guys who all look the same. And she was like, it's like apple choosing between apples and oranges and kiwi and cantaloupe. So I'm going to say that Late Night and The Farewell are kiwi and cantaloupe.
Okay.
I think the major difference between the two movies, which is maybe a nuance that was lost from, you know, not being on the ground at Sundance, was that The Farewell was much, much better liked than Late Night. It got pretty much unanimously positive reviews. Late Night, a lot of people were mixed on. And so I don't think that Late Night had really the critical momentum going into its opening as much as that counts for anything. But The Farewell will have a raft of support, not just because it's a great movie, but because it is, you know, and maybe this is a tired old saw, it is a really great example of what representation on screen can mean and what different kinds of stories can be told when Hollywood, you know, widens its purview. So I think that despite Late Night's many advantages, I'm one of the bigger fans of that movie. I think The Farewell is better positioned to be a sort of summer thing. But yes, that said, Joanna, like, I'm sure that people at Amazon are having some dark days right now.
Yeah, The Farewell seems to have, like, and we talk about eighth grade all the time as kind of the model for this, like something that you feel like you get to discover on your own and get to tell other people about, which is like the benefit of a slow release. I think Late Night opened really wide, really fast, which a lot of people credited as one of the things that went wrong. They spent a ton of money marketing it. And The Farewell, especially for what you've been saying, Richard, like it's got this like heartstring tugging aspect to it. Like it has an emotional pull, not just like a quality pull. And I think eighth grade had the same thing, which is part of what makes people like really want to flock to see it.
I'll be really curious to see. We talked a lot last summer about how much an impact MoviePass was having in terms of, it was called MoviePass, right?
How soon we forget.
I'm sorry, what now?
God, Joanna just, when they're dead, Joanna just forgets them.
How much an impact MoviePass had on the indie box office last year in terms of like people just feeling like they had more of a budget to go see these smaller films, and word of mouth helped things like Eighth Grade or RBG or, you know, various things. And so I'll be curious to see when we do a forensic analysis of the year, if there is a big difference in terms of how those indie darlings are doing, those indie summer darlings. And I don't know if you guys have seen the sort of depressing midway through the year statistics or charts that just show, I mean, this is kiwis and cantaloupes, but show the Disney box office versus every other studio.
Oh my God.
And like, it's really upsetting to see.
It looks like the line is going to go around the graph and then come back around. Like it's fully going to lap every other studio somehow.
Yeah, it's like that one kid in your fifth grade class who had like three rows of stars before anyone else had finished one when their book reading chart. But yeah, so I don't know. I'm hopeful that people go see these smaller films. I really loved Last Black Man in San Francisco. I think it did okay. Midsummer is doing pretty well, and I hope this does really well. So I'll be seeing it.
Well, speaking of smaller movies, I guess that's my best transition we can get to. There's a trailer out for the Judy Garland biopic, Judy, that stars Renee Zellweger. We'd seen a teaser for it a while ago, and the full trailer came out this week. It'll be out later this year. I can feel like I can say up front, it's not a great trailer, but that isn't necessarily the judge of a movie. It's really, I mean, I think this movie will live and die based on Renee Zellweger's performance as Judy Garland. And I do think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on in there. What did you guys think about that trailer?
Well, Katie, there is nothing small about Judy Garland. Nor is there anything small about Renee Zellweger.
No, not that. That's very true. It is a large movie. It's the pictures that got small.
The hit of the, yeah, that first teaser, which was really effective, and then you know, which is often happens when they have to do like the full 2.5 minute trailer, where you have to actually show people talking, and or unless you're Lion King, you're like, oh, it's just this biopic thing. And Zellweger, who I am more than rooting for, to have a comeback with this movie this year, their voice work seems a little too charactery. You know,
which is so hard because she is such, it's like Liza Minnelli too, like they are such characters that like any impression you do is going to sound crazy because they were so weird.
Well, right. You know, and the thing
you just alienated like yeah. so much of our audience by calling Liza Minnelli and Judy Garland crazy and weird.
Oh my God. they are beloved icons, but they are incredibly unique. How's
Glad
that?
Issue a statement against Little Goldman. I think the thing hampering Judy's, you know, Oscar chances is that the Academy never gives awards to like crazy over the top musical biopic performances. Like that just doesn't happen.
No, absolutely.
There's no recent history of it. There's no old history of it.
No.
So yeah, that's me saying that like I'm trying to be like, don't be too nervous about the Renaissance based on this trailer, but it's not a great second step for that movie.
Joanna, where'd you land on it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me. I don't know if I talked about this when we talked about the teaser, but Judy Davis has, for me, done the iconic like Judy Garland performance, and it's hard for me to see anyone else do it. I also, along with Richard, am heartily rooting for Renee Zellweger. So, like, if not this project, then hopefully something. Like, hopefully this isn't, like, the one chance and then nothing. I hope it's the beginning, just the spear tip of more to come from Renee. But I'm not delighted by this trailer. No.
Did you guys watch the Netflix series that Renee was on that came out a few weeks ago that I saw mostly in GIFs on Twitter, and I wasn't sure what kind of audience share it got?
What If it was called, I believe.
Yeah.
No, I started it, and I'll be honest, it bummed me out for her. So I was just like, you know what? Just wait for Judy.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, and just I think that was what a lot of people did. I hear from people that show dropped pretty quickly as a priority for Netflix. Maybe I'm speaking out of school and maybe I'm speaking incorrectly, but that's what I've heard in the wind. So I'm choosing to say, well, forget that being part of the Zellweger narrative this year. It lives and dies by Judy.
It's all about Judy. Mm-hmm. Well, Judy's set for late September release, which to me makes it seem decently likely we'll see it in Toronto. That lineup's coming out, or the first part of that lineup's coming out in 2 weeks. So we might know a lot more about Judy really soon.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Okay, so now it is time to get our predicting hats on, which is something that we always happily do on this show and then always embrace when we are wrong, which it seems like you're inevitably going to be. I don't actually have to write formal Emmy predictions for VF.com. Joanna, I know you're working on that. So anything I say here, you can hold against me, but I'll pretend I never said it and I won't be held to it. So let's predict the Emmy nominations a little bit. I think we've talked over the last couple of weeks about how the top categories like comedy series, drama series feel a little bit foretold for Veep and Game of Thrones. But starting with comedy, what else do you guys see on the horizon that maybe you'd be excited about or you want to see try to at least compete with Veep?
For me, I mean, there's a lot. This is such a good time for comedy and a competitive time for comedy. You know, our colleague Sonia Soraya also helped with our predictions. Richard has some predictions in there. And I believe Sonia did comedy, right, Richard?
I didn't, so I hope so. Okay.
So Sonia's big is like the world's biggest champion of Barry. So Barry is like a, you know, a thing that we're kind of putting some muscle behind. But like also Fleabag. A Russian Doll. Like, these are great, great comedies that, you know, were it not for this being Veep's sort of like final lap around the rink. I don't know. Why did I try to do a sports metaphor?
Rink, yeah.
Yeah, for skating. I think one of those, Russian Doll especially, being like such a fun surprise breakout of the year, might have a better chance. What do you think, Richard?
Well, I'm looking at Gold Derby, which, you know, can be a help or a hindrance, depending. And I do see a few people predicting, I mean, it's just a few, Schitt's Creek. You know, it's down six or seven on their list of possible nominees. But that would be really exciting, and I think would be another example of the Emmys, you know, being this big ship that's slow to turn to recognize something like, you know, only nominating the Americans at the very end. A lot of which comes from huge swells of critical and audience, you know, support and campaigning. And I think that would be what would happen with Schitt's Creek, is that people are finally like, oh, right, this thing that, you know, it's a cult hit. It's not like the biggest show on TV by any means, but a lot of people love passionately. That could be
well.
Really
it also debuted on Netflix this year, which like all of a sudden has turned it visible in a way it never was before.
Yeah, and I should apologize actually now that I have this platform. So I wrote about the show right before this new season premiered, and I was just like, yeah, I was sleeping on the show. You're right, it's great. And I have to begrudgingly thank Netflix because, you know, I wouldn't have caught up with it otherwise. And I read a report, I don't know, for some Canadian website a couple days after that, that on stage at some sort of panel, one of the heads of programming for CBC, which, you know, kind of fostered the show into existence in Canada, said that she was like heartbroken to read that Vanity Fair gave Netflix credit for Schitt's Creek.
Oh, no.
I was like, no, that's not what I meant. All I meant was that, yeah, like you said, Katie, you know, with so many other shows, 90210, Friends, what all the other things that people are revisiting, Netflix is, you know, can help a show immensely.
Well, yeah. It's not even, what's funny is Netflix isn't even like the U.S. distributor that's Pop is like, you know, it's a CBC show that airs here on Pop, and then Netflix still doesn't even have the latest season of Schitt's Creek, which, you know, debuted earlier this year. And I know it must be frustrating for these networks. I mean, but like we've seen that with Riverdale for CW, like Riverdale didn't pop till it hit Netflix, or You for Lifetime, and Lifetime I think gave You, like wound up like giving You, or however you give a series, to Netflix.
Yeah.
And then it like exploded for them, and then now Netflix has season two, and Lifetime's like, damn it. You know, so like, you know, Pop is still hanging on to Schitt's Creek, but what's funny is, I remember, I don't know if I've told you this story before. This is Joanna Repeats Stories on the podcast, but I remember when Schitt's Creek had a panel at TCA, and I perked up because I like Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, but I was like, they showed like some scenes from the show, and I was like, I'm not that interested in this. This doesn't, you know, this looks like a kind of broad comedy I wouldn't be that interested in. I had no idea who Dan Levy was. And then Jarrett Weisselman, who then worked for BuzzFeed but now works for Netflix, he was like, I love this show. And I was like, no one in the room cares about the show. He's like, yeah, but I love this show, trust me. And so
so you're giving Jarrett credit for all of this?
I'm gonna give Jarrett credit for that. I would like programmer at CBC to give Jarrett Weisselman credit. No, I mean, he was the only one in that entire room, I swear to God, paying attention to that show. And now it's like everyone's eating it up with a spoon. So.
Another crazy example of Netflix giving a show a bump is, and I think I'm remembering my history right, is The Walking Dead.
Huh.
That show premiered and it was like, okay. And then they put it right on Netflix. Like that was when AMC was doing that. They also did it with Breaking Bad.
It was huge for Breaking Bad. Yeah, that is a fact.
Yeah. It was definitely, but I think Walking Dead also like got a huge bump. So anyway, it's just a weird phenomenon. But yeah, I think, yeah, all credit to Jarrett for being there first.
No.
But, you know.
I didn't mean that. It was just funny. It's funny to think about being in a room with all these TV journalists. And everyone was just like, when you're at TCA, there are panels where everyone's paying attention and there are panels where everyone's just like looking at their phone or whatever. And that was one where like no one was paying attention. And now everyone is obsessed with Schitt's Creek. And I was just like, that's a sad day. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's just fun to think about.
It worked out well for everyone.
But I don't know if Schitt's Creek will make it into the main comedy category, but there's such a groundswell of support for Catherine O'Hara to get a nomination. And that would be, I think, incredible.
So should we talk about comedy actress then, if we're talking about Catherine O'Hara?
Sure.
I mean, the idea of a category that includes Catherine O'Hara versus Julia Louis-Dreyfus is, and then probably Lily Tomlin, and probably Allison Janney, like that is a formidable lineup.
Or Natasha Lyonne or Phoebe Waller-Bridge or Pamela Adlin or Rachel Brosnahan. Like, it's just a murderous row of talent there.
And and Christina Applegate for the laugh a minute comedy Dead to Me. Which, like, yes, has funny parts, and Christina Applegate and Linda Cardellini are funny actresses, but, like, I don't know. That feels like a weird category insertion, but it's a half an hour, so that's why they did it.
That's so funny. The half hour thing, the half hour rule really just continues to get things. I had, like, I think a few weeks ago I talked about how I wasn't really letting myself get my hopes up for Fleabag, but now I kind of am. I feel like Phoebe Waller-Bridge is a decent bet now.
Yeah, at least, I think I said this before, but, like, at least in, like, some kind of writing category, right?
For sure.
But, like, but yeah, overall, I mean, it would be amazing to see Fleabag represented that way. I'm not seeing a lot of support for my fave Andrew Scott, because I guess his part is not really funny at all. But Olivia Colman, you know, like, fresh off an Oscar win, you know, might squeak in there. And she is absolutely one of the funniest parts of the show. So there's that.
There's a lot of that fresh off the Oscar win stuff. I mean, I was doing the, for the Emmy predictions, I did, like, all the TV movie and miniseries thing, where you get a lot of, you know, movie actors kind of moonlighting on TV. You know, you have Sam Rockwell, Mahershala Ali. And so I found myself wondering, Patricia Arquette, to some extent, her Oscar was a little bit, you know, a few years ago. But I found myself wondering how much that counts for Emmy voters. And I feel like it has to a little bit.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you think about when, like, the Big Little Lies crew was all, like, going around, and you get Nicole Kidman. It's like, Nicole Kidman, she's got an Oscar. She's the person that we're going to, like, rally behind. Reese Witherspoon has an Oscar, too. But I think that glow of having huge deal movie stars in these categories still really exists, especially with, like, Mahershala Ali, who is just on the streak where he kind of can't stop winning things. Although that movie miniseries actor category is really competitive. I'm not really even sure I know who would win in all of that.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly those categories are just bloodbaths, you know, like,
yeah,
when I was making my short list of, like, the six for each, I would look at who was left on the cutting room floor, and I was like, Jesus, like any of those people could easily win, let alone be nominated. So it'll be really interesting to see where the Emmy's focus has been. I think that for me, the TV narratives of at least this second half of the 2018-19 season were Fleabag, which is why I think Phoebe Waller-Bridge is in good shape, and then Chernobyl.
Yeah.
And I think Jared Harris, Emily Watson, Stellan Skarsgård, they're all going to get nominated in various categories. And I think that show will win for TV limited series.
What would it beat for limited? I'm sorry, I'm looking at Gold Derby now, but I'm just thinking about what competition it's going to...
Fosse Verdon would be a big one.
Yeah, Sharp Objects.
Sharp Objects, which, you know, that's Sharp Objects is on a lot of the Gold Derby predictions, and it's on mine, but I put them on sort of reluctantly because I was like, as much as that show was great and
so good,
worthy of things, it was a year ago. I don't know that it has... I feel like if anything gets, like, bizarrely forgotten, it could be that.
I completely agree. Like, I love Sharp Objects. I like Sharp Objects better than Big Little Lies. I like it so much. I don't know why I'm comparing those two.
Same director.
Yeah, sure. That's why. It's not because all women's stories are the same. It has been forgotten, and it's so disappointing to me that Amy Adams could do all of that and get nothing is a disgrace. I'll go ahead and say it.
I mean, this paste that back onto what we were all saying for Arrival when she didn't get nominated for that a couple years ago. It's becoming a theme for her, unfortunately.
It's true.
It does make me wonder if we're going to get in. And I guess we're kind of sort of in this period already, but having TV work like the Oscars, where all of the prestige movies come out within the same month-long period in December. Because if something like Sharp Objects gets blanked because it came out too long ago, whereas Fosse Verdon, Chernobyl, When They See Us are all way more recent, like, I don't know, they might all just pile on top of each other in a way that's kind of harder on TV than it is for movies, I think.
And I think TV critics are already feeling that. The May crush this year was, like, sort of unbearable. So, you know, Emmy is seasoned. Tis upon us. And it's just so much harder to, like, watch all 10 hours or whatever of the Emmy-eligible thing than, like, go to a film festival and watch all the Oscar nominees. So,
oh God, you know. So much time.
Pour one out for the poor TV critics. Do we want to talk about if anything has a chance up against Game of Thrones?
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at Gold Derby again, just trying to see, like, nobody has anything but Game of Thrones really at the top of their predictions, which is hard to imagine. I mean, What are the buzzy drama? I guess Succession is the other like regular drama that's got buzz comparable to Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Succession is in there, and you know, like Better Call Saul and This Is Us are like perennial nominees that they'll be in there. But it's just a funny and like absent year because The Crown doesn't have, and Handmaid's Tale both are not eligible. Yeah. The Americans is over. House of Cards, which was the usual nominee, is sort of scandal plagued, and so like there's some option for some fresh blood. Succession is one. I'm kind of hoping that Pose gets in there. I think that would be a really cool thing, and I think it's possible that the Television Academy wants to show itself as like, you know, a little less musty than it sometimes is. So I think Pose would be a great opportunity for it to do that.
It also just debuted its second season, which is a great way if you're, because it's the first season that's eligible, but that's a good way if you're kind of an older show to get yourself back in the conversation is to have a new season.
Remember? I know that's the thing when we do this is we always have to like double check, you know, which season is being nominated
because
sometimes it's not what you expect. Because I was like, is Killing Eve being nominated for first season or second season? It's second season, which was the less successful season, I think. But I still think Killing Eve and its lead actresses, Sandra Oh, Jodie Comer, will probably get in there as sort of a make good for the Television Academy overlooking them last year. So
yeah, Killing Eve feels like it fell in this very strange buzz pocket where like it got really big for its first season while it was still eligible, but it had to kind of build. So that by the time the Emmys happened, the first season Killing Eve was huge, but like it hadn't gotten there fast enough to get the nominations in place.
Right. The other thing that I wanted to ask you guys about, and I'm going to direct this maybe at our resident Ozark head, Richard, which is Ozark is fairly high on some Gold Derby lists. When I was making our drama predictions, I was less inclined to back it only because it hasn't been nominated before. I didn't think the second season was as well-liked as the first season, and I don't really understand why it's up there other than the fact that like maybe Netflix is throwing a lot of its campaign money behind it because it doesn't have like it doesn't really have a shot with House of Cards or Orange is the New Black, and so perhaps Ozark is its best chance at getting into some of these drama categories. What do you think, Richard, of Ozark in that conversation?
I mean, isn't Ozark sort of the Kominsky method? I mean, isn't it like?
but that's Golden Globes. Like Kominsky method is Golden Globes, and like Ozark being a Golden Globe show, I understand. But is it an Emmy show? Like, I don't.
Well, that's
don't
the thing. I don't know. I mean, you know, I a lot of people watch it, is my understanding. It's pretty good. I mean, it's well acted. But I feel like that's a show that will be used almost as like filler. Like it's like, okay, we got to get to how many nominations, like that'll be one of them. Because it's just like an easy one to vote for in a way. And also because it's very present in that I'm sure Netflix is doing, you know, at least enough FYC stuff to get it in the mix. I would love to see Laura Linney get nominated for an Emmy in 2019. That would be fun. I mean, she also had Tales of the City this year, so she's in people's minds, certainly.
It's crazy that she didn't like it. Jason Bateman got nominated last year and it got a couple of other technical nominations, but it's crazy that Laura Linney didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think of all the nominations I would like to see, Laura Linney get nominated would be great. Julia Garner, I also like generally, you know, for her work across a number of shows. Richard and I had a conversation around whether or not her season two performance on Ozark was as good as season one. But, like, Gold Derby has Jason Bateman, Laura Linney, Julia Garner, and Ozark in the main category. And I'm like, you want Ozark to run the board? Like, what's, I mean, not to win necessarily, but I was surprised by that presence over something like Pose, which I think has broken through in a bigger way than Ozark has. So
I wanted to talk about Pose because I'm really hoping that is able to break through. It just got renewed for season three, so FX is clearly behind the show. And just looking at the wide sort of field of potential nominees this year when I was putting together my predictions, but also looking at other people's, is this is a pretty non-diverse group of actors this year for some reason. And, you know, there are a few people here and there. Certainly Ava DuVernay's series When They See Us has some great options in Niecy Nash or Michael K. Williams. But Pose would offer the opportunity to nominate some exciting young actresses who a lot of people haven't seen before, a lot of us haven't seen before, you know, and whether it's India Moore or any of them who are on Pose and are so good on it. That said, what am I seeing as the potential acting nominees from that show? it's guest actor Christopher Maloney and guest actress Sandra Bernhard, you know, and it's like, okay, like, so you're recognizing this show, but you're sort of pointing to the more established white people who have, you know, blown through the show. Not that they aren't great on it, but I don't know. I just think the Pose narrative is going to be really interesting. And I would almost wonder if part of it is, and I feel like a nomination for that show in Best Drama Series would be the win, in a way, you know what I mean? Is because the season two marketing campaign with those photographs was so stunning that, and they're everywhere in New York City on subway entrances and everything, and they still grab my eye even though I've seen them a million times. So I don't know, I just kind of wonder if that would have had any impact, because it really is the most striking ad campaign for a show I've seen in a while.
I'm seeing Billy Porter on a lot of people's lists for drama actors, so I hope that means he has a good shot as well.
Well, especially because he's in our, you know, special awards issue.
Oh, yeah, you had lunch with him, Richard. Yeah, the Richard Lawson touch is what's going to get him there.
I that was worth it in its own right, but, you know, that would be a cherry on top if you get nominated.
I have Billy Porter and I have MJ Rodriguez sort of in my prediction/wish list. But like, all of this is going to bump up against Game of Thrones, which I, you know, will be interesting to see. Like, the nominations I'm not worried about for Game of Thrones. It's the win that is actually a question mark for the first time in a while. I still think it's going to win everything, but like, there is so much ill will. the narrative around it is so sort of toxic for the final season that I'll be curious. But so once again, they're running Emilia Clarke and Kit Harington in the lead categories. I think Emilia is sort of, they both got sort of screwed over by doing that last year. They ran in lead and neither of them got nominated. Yeah. I think there's a better case for them as leads this year. And I think Emilia Clarke especially, even though she was given like a very tough script, I think she did a lot with it. And her best work, I think, on the series. So I would be really comfortable with her getting a nomination. Kit also did a good job, but there's a lot of tough competition for him in the dramatic actor category. And then for supporting with the Thrones actors, I know people joke about Lena Headey like just standing in a window and sipping wine this season, but she's been nominated like every season for the last that she's been eligible for the last like 5 years. She's just an iconic part of the show. I don't see her like not getting this final nomination. I would love to see one for Sophie Turner. Nikolai Coster-Waldau, of course, my favorite. And then Peter Dinklage actually, I think, did a great job this year. He's been kind of sleepwalking in some of the, like, he won for a season that I think he sleepwalked through.
And that was the one where he was like, did I win this? Really?
Yeah, he was like, really? but this year, I think he actually like sort of like woke up, was like, this is the end. I will bring what I can and did. So, you know, like those are some of the people. And like, the main competition I see for Peter Dinklage is Kieran Culkin, which would be a win that I would personally love for Succession. So I don't know.
That would be really fun.
There's a lot of good options, but it's hard to, you know, we can talk all we want about the general perception of Game of Thrones, but the way in which the Television Academy views how Game of Thrones changed how TV is seen in the world, I think can't be underestimated.
Also, Joanna, as someone who has stood by many windows sipping many glasses of wine, it's hard to be good at it, and she is good at it, because I'm a mess. So
yeah, I didn't get an Emmy nomination for it.
I know. I mean, it's hard to smirk and sip at the same time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, exactly.
To stick with drama for another minute and kind of to go back to Netflix, we were talking about Ozark as something Netflix was really, really getting behind. But I'm curious about Bodyguard, which feels like yet another show that Netflix picked up and all of a sudden became a really huge thing. And, you know, I have yet to watch it, but I feel like I hear about it constantly. I wonder if that might make a stronger showing than we expect as well.
The narrative is actually a little reverse. It was the biggest show ever in the UK when it premiered on the BBC. And then it hit here slightly more muted. And I think it got an uptick when Richard Madden won the Golden Globe. And I think he won the Golden Globe because like that's the Hollywood foreign press.
Sure.
And they're like, this is the biggest show in the UK. Here you go, Richard Madden. Also, he's great in it. But I was, when I picked Richard Madden for our little like, something for our Emmys issue. And I think I messaged you, Katie, and I was like, my heart says Richard or my head says Richard. And you're like, do Richard then. I picked Richard Madden for that category because...
To win, to be clear. Like, to win. You're predicting that he's going to win.
To, like, win. over, I guess, like Bob Odenkirk, who's been nominated a bunch of times but has never won. And a bunch of people think like maybe this is his year. Maybe this is Better Call Saul's year. But I pick Richard not just because he is good in The Bodyguard, which he is, not just because he has the Golden Globe win, because also he was so great in Rocketman, because he's rumored to be Bond. His stock is just like on such a rise right now, I think, outside of my bubble, hopefully, as well. And also how juicy and ironic it would be if he won and like Kit Harington didn't. Like if Richard Madden won in the category and Kit Harington
Rob
wasn't,
Stark's
like,
revenge.
Yeah, Rob Stark wins, Jon Snow gets blanked. I don't know. That's just something I've been thinking about.
Is there anyone else from Bodyguard to look out for acting wise?
I put Keeley Hawes in there because she's also like someone who's been around on TV for a long time, especially if you're aware of UK TV. And she's in a supporting category, even though she's kind of the de facto co-lead, is complicated. But she's I think quite good in it. So I would keep your eye on Keeley Hawes. Why not?
Sure. Well, I wanted to talk about guest actor categories briefly just because I think they're extremely fun. It's where you see nominations for people who are like, oh, I didn't know that they were eligible for an Emmy at all. And I believe they're still not handed out during the major telecast, so it's something you hear about before the Emmy Awards happen. But when I was glad to see that Gold Derby was getting into this because otherwise it's incredibly hard to keep track of. But one of the ones that I really got into the idea of was Maya Rudolph for The Good Place.
Love it.
As the judge, which would be extremely fun. And also, I don't know if I might be the biggest Mrs. Maisel fan at this point, but Jane Lynch had this great arc on the previous season as this really kind of fake vaudeville comedian, and she's kind of up there high on people's list too. So those are two people who I was rooting hard for.
Katie, you don't want to see Cate Blanchett nominated for an Emmy?
I mean, so I haven't seen Documentary Now, which is the, I don't know, makes me not get me kicked off Twitter. Tell me about Cate Blanchett's Documentary Now Emmy buzz.
So her mockumentary, whatever you want to call it, is a spoof of The Artist's Present about Marina Abramovich and the, mm-hmm. you know, that famous exhibit she did where she just sits in a chair and stares at people. I mean, it's more than that. And the funny thing about that, or the not funny thing about that, is that it's played very straight. And there's a joke because it's so similar, but that's kind of it. Like, there are serious moments in it and whatever. She is typically great. She's doing an accent. Like, she's fun in it. But my investment in her being nominated in the guest comedy actress category, which, you know, she's ranked on some people's shortlist right now, is that she is kind of dismayingly far behind on her EGOT. She's only got one.
How's that G gonna happen?
Where's her T?
Has all her theater work been in Australia? Like, does she have like 8 Australian Tonys?
She's only been on Broadway once, and it was in a play that was not well received at all. Everything else, you know, when she played Blanche DuBois, a performance I think that she's still not shaken. When she did all the maids with Isabelle Huppert, all that stuff, that's all been like at BAM or whatever, which is not mm-hmm. Broadway. So she's only got the O. And I think the E, you know, that would be great because when, you know, I guess everyone else is going to TV, so maybe she'll end up in some elegant miniseries or something. But
yeah, she's never had an Emmy nomination, which, like, I mean, you know, obviously she's a movie star, but at this point, like, most of them have Emmy nominations somewhere in their history.
Nope, she's never done really TV, so until now. So
although she's playing Phyllis Schlafly in an upcoming series, so if she doesn't make it this year, her chance is coming.
Okay.
Yes, and Documentary Now is an amazing series generally, but the my stealth person that I would love to see get nominated is Richard Kine, who is in this like spoof of the Company cast recording that they did for Documentary Now, which was just like so very much for me, and it turns out every other TV critic is a huge
Company
fan.
Yeah, it's like the nichiest hit in the world, but it was a hit for its niche.
But yeah, John Mulaney as Sondheim is great, but Richard Kine and Richard Kine has just been doing like great TV work forever, so like it would be great to see him in there. But he and Paula Pell both just sort of like steal that whole thing, walk right away with it. And then the other guest actor thing that I want to look at is the SNL hosts. They usually like get in there, and I think Mulaney would be a great pick for that one. He is like now my favorite SNL host when he shows up, you know, because he was such a long time great writer for them. So he shows up and you can like feel his hand on the various sketches, and it's just good stuff. But there's other, you know, there's like Awkwafina or like, you know, various other hosts.
Sandra that could O. Get in there.
Yeah, Sandra Oh, whoever.
Would this be for his Les Mis lobster parody?
I mean,
like, is, no. is that the same episode?
No,
or not?
He did a New York Bodega one.
Oh, the
one
Bodega
was,
one. Yeah,
which is
okay.
Like essentially the same concept. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the like weird scandal of the Emmy guest categories, right, is that Peter McNichol is back in for Veep after he got like nominated and then disqualified at the last moment because he had been in too much of the series. So they calibrated his appearance this season so that he was in just the right amount to get that guest actor nomination again. So it might be nice for Peter McNichol to get the win, because I think he was like considered the favorite to win the year that he was disqualified. And he is, I mean, he's fantastic on Veep. So
I totally forgot that it happened. What drama.
What an Emmy scandal.
I know. Okay, we're maybe close to the end of Emmys. Any other big categories you guys are excited about? Any bold predictions you want to make?
I want to talk just a second about reality host.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Because, you know, it was exciting. I believe it was last year that RuPaul Charles won and Drag Race won for reality competition program, and that was really exciting, you know, after like almost a decade of kind of guerrilla cult support for that show. It finally broke through the membrane of public consciousness. And this year, RuPaul is likely to be nominated again alongside Ellen for her really cruel game show where she makes people do stupid things for money and laughs at them. it's like something out of ancient Rome. It's crazy.
I had no idea.
Yeah, it's sadistic. Jane Lynch for Hollywood Game Night. And then, interestingly, Amy Poehler and Nick Offerman for Making It, which was a really cute kind of, you know, I don't know what you craft series sort of. And then, well, they're just listed as Queer Eye and then a parentheses for, you know, Queer Eye. Like, so the Fab Five would be nominated as one unit and could potentially upset RuPaul or whoever else, which, you know, I don't know. So that narrative, I think, is kind of interesting. You know, the Emmys were slow to diversify their reality, you know, categories. And now they're, you know, they're actually rewarding stuff that people seem invested in, which is nice.
I just don't know why Marie Kondo doesn't have more Emmy buzz.
That's a great question, actually.
Just imagine what she could bring. I mean, honestly, I'd just like to see her on the red carpet. She'll probably be there anyway. But
do you think she would like hold on to her statue, or would
no,
she, like,
she would get rid of it. That's the crazy thing. She'd like hand it to somebody on the stage and like let it go from her life. Well, as I said, we're going to be back to talk about the Emmy nominations as they come in next Tuesday. Richard, you'll be off in Los Angeles receiving mm-hmm. your Emmy, I believe. That's how that works.
Emmys, Katie.
Yeah,
Emmys.
So congratulations. Anyway, we'll be back to talk about all of that. And in the meantime, you can find us at VanityFair.com with the Emmy predictions from you guys that will be going up later this week as well. You can find us on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Brian Laws.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of Richard's upcoming trip to VidCon goes to Richard Lawson.
It's like something out of ancient Rome. It's sadistic.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.